Speaking of deer hunting, it is opening weekend for firearms. So many people coming north. So many people making sure they tune their dial to KEXE to listen to Green Cheese Saturday night. It's going to be the Crab Sisters extravaganza. We want to hear what your traditions are at hunting camp, or stories that you have to share, even recipes you might share. We talked with some folks on the morning show on Wednesday about some of the events going on that are craft sales or sales at area restaurants and shops that bring in people who are not deer hunters but might be coming to the region as well. So maybe that's part of your tradition. You can text us 218-326-1234. If you checked out the new Season Watch pod, it's cool, it's fun, you learn a lot. Check it out at kexe.org or try Spotify. It'll be there as well. It's a minute after six.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. This is day 37 of the federal government shutdown. It's held up the payment of food benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. These benefit cuts could end up being far steeper this month than expected. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on a new analysis.
Under a court order, the Trump administration is tapping a contingency fund to restart SNAP food aid. It said it should cover about half of people's benefits for November. But Katie Berg with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says it appears most people will actually get less than that. In fact,
almost 5 million people will receive no benefits at all.
The center also estimates the administration will not spend all of its contingency fund. The Agriculture Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Meanwhile, some states say the formula for calculating partial payments is too labor intensive and getting them to people will take weeks. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has held a classified briefing for top congressional leaders. It was about deadly U.S. military strikes on boats in the Eastern Pacific and Caribbean. President Trump alleges they're involved in drug trafficking. NPR's Claudia Grisales has more.
Republicans and Democrats left the classified meeting divided on President Trump's ordered strikes, but agreed the military is relying on strong intelligence targeting drug traffickers. House Speaker Mike Johnson argued the operation has, quote, saved lives.
We have a high reliability. These are the cartels. These are the people involved in it. They are doing this deliberately. They are intending to traffic this into the country, and it does great harm to the American people.
But Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, quote, we need a lot more answers. The meeting follows growing frustrations the Trump administration has withheld information about the attacks that could lead to war with Venezuela. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard lengthy arguments yesterday about President Trump's tariffs. The president is using the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose these, but the law does not explicitly say a thing about tariffs. Amy Howe of SCOTUS blog says some of the court's conservative justices expressed doubt that the president has the power to use the law this way.
They certainly did seem to have the vote of Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was one of the strongest defenders of the challengers. And, you know, Justice Amy Coney Barrett had some questions that were skeptical. Chief Justice John Roberts also had some questions that seemed to be very skeptical. So it seemed that there was probably a majority to strike down the tariffs.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Despite the justices' skepticism, it is not clear what their final decision will be. The decision is expected sometime next year. This is NPR. Kentucky officials have increased the death toll to 12 people from Tuesday's UPS cargo plane crash in Louisville. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear has declared a state of emergency and mobilized the National Guard to help. Big tech company Google and video game maker Epic Games have agreed to settle a long-running dispute. The dispute has been over Google's App Store. NPR's John Ruwich reports the two companies are asking a federal court to approve their settlement.
Epic Games sued Google 5 years ago, arguing that Google's Play Store for apps on Android devices was a monopoly with high fees. Epic won in 2023, and a judge later said Google must allow other app stores on Android. But Google appealed late last year, and the case has dragged on. Now, Google and Epic say they've agreed to a set of changes to Android and Google Play. Google says they focus on expanding developer choice and flexibility, lowering fees, and encouraging more competition while keeping users safe. If approved, the settlement ends one of several cases that Google faces challenging its dominance over swaths of the internet. Google is a financial supporter of NPR. John Ruich, NPR News.
French auditors are calling on the Louvre Museum in Paris to speed up their security modifications. This comes after burglars stole millions of dollars in historical jewels in a brazen daytime robbery. The French officials say the museum began a security audit years ago, but the recommended upgrades to the Louvre Museum will not be finished until 2032. On Wall Street and pre-market trading, stock futures are mixed. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Total Wine & More, offering a variety of beverages for gatherings and crisp fall nights. More at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. This is day 37 of a now record-long government shutdown. In a few moments, we'll speak with Republican Congressman Jeff Hurd about his work on a bipartisan effort to break through the stalemate.
First, though, Democratic wins in elections across the country on Tuesday have emboldened many to hold firm. That's despite earlier indications that they were searching for a way out as Americans felt the intense pains of furloughs, travel delays, and unpaid SNAP benefits.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass is here. So, all right, Sam, let's start with the view from the White House. And he met with Senate Republicans for breakfast yesterday. What was his message? What did he say to them?
The president told Senate Republicans there was a lot to discuss, including what the party should do about their losses on election night.
And also about the shutdown, how that relates to last night. I think if you read the pollsters, the shutdown was a big factor, negative for the Republicans.
Trump has been urging Republicans to end the shutdown by eliminating the Senate filibuster. That would lower the votes needed to pass bills. Congressional Republicans, you know, have mostly gone along with Trump's wishes, but Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota says getting rid of the filibuster is just not going to happen.
The Senate was designed to really be a place where consensus is brought about to making decisions that could stand the test of time. Simply going to make the Senate a mini version of the House is not what any of us really want to do.
And there's another reason Republicans are hesitant to ditch the filibuster. They want to keep it in case they end up in the minority.
All right, so if most Republicans then are saying no to President Trump's desire to bust the filibuster, I mean, are we seeing a different solution emerge?
So both sides have been pretty dug in here, but this week some bipartisan talks did seem to pick up steam, possibly a short-term funding measure into December, along with votes on a small package of regular appropriations bills. Democratic Senator John Ossoff of Georgia has been involved in those talks, and I asked whether he'd accept anything short of a deal to preserve expiring Obamacare subsidies. That's an issue that's been at the heart of this shutdown debate.
Conversations are ongoing. It's good that people are talking. There's real urgency to prevent this huge spike in healthcare costs and to reopen the government.
Republicans would need 8 Democrats to sign on to a deal to reopen the government, and Republicans have said that would become more doable as the shutdown pain got worse.
So how do the election results affect all that?
Well, there has always been a camp of Democrats who say any deal has to include an ironclad extension of those Obamacare subsidies. And many of them think their performance on Tuesday validates that position. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says he needs not just a Senate vote on extending the subsidies, but also assurance that the measure would pass in the House and that Trump would sign it into law.
If you simply had a nebulous vote that wasn't going to go anyplace, I think we got to continue the fight.
On Tuesday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was kind of vague about what he could live with. On Wednesday, he made it sound like his caucus was not going to relent.
The election results were not vague. They were not unclear. They were a lightning bolt.
So, Sam, where does this leave things?
Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries are calling for a meeting with Trump on Air Force One on Sunday. I asked Trump whether he was interested in negotiating with Democrats, but he reiterated that they were the ones who needed to back down. The question is, will Tuesday change that calculus, or will this shutdown stretch into a sixth week?
That's NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
We're going to focus now on a possible compromise. On Monday, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in the House pitched an off-ramp for the government shutdown. 4 members of the House Problem Solvers Caucus released a framework that would extend the enhanced Obamacare subsidies at the heart of the standoff in Congress. Republican Congressman Jeff Hurd of Colorado signed on to this effort, and he joins me now. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Leila. Happy to join you.
Thank you for being back on the program. Okay, so this is really the first time we're seeing a suggestion of compromise here on health care to reopen the government. What is your group proposing exactly?
So this is a bipartisan legislative framework that I'm putting forward along with my colleagues Tom Suozzi, Josh Gottheimer, and Don Bacon. It's meant to prevent a sharp rise in health insurance costs for people that are buying plans on the individual market. And what we're doing, what this legislative framework says is, let's extend the enhanced premium tax credits for 2 years, set reasonable income caps so that the help goes to the families that need it the most, and then we can build in some stronger guardrails so that the system is more accountable. And then Congress can use that breathing room in the next 2 years to work on long-term reform.
So there's 4 of you. How much support does it have beyond the 4 of you among the 2 parties and also the president?
I think there is room here for a lot of support. This is an issue, I will tell you, regardless of how red or blue your district is, healthcare and the cost of health insurance is a top issue. So not everyone agrees that this is necessarily the right solution, but this is a framework to begin discussions. I think there's a real, I'm cautiously optimistic that we will get a lot of legislative support and this thing could really get some momentum.
How much does Tuesday maybe thaw things out a little bit and open a spirit of compromise? We saw that Democrats scored big wins Tuesday in swing districts where Republicans had done well in the past. And we heard President Trump there say the shutdown hurt Republicans with voters. Do you think this will get this atmosphere and what we saw on Tuesday might get more people willing to compromise rather than to hold ground like we've seen for 5 weeks?
Well, look, I'll let smarter people than me who are more familiar with Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City weigh in on the specifics of those elections. But what I can tell you is that on the Hill here in Washington, D.C., we're anxious to get the government back open and to start tackling the key problems that we were sent here to tackle. The people that I represent in Western and Southern Colorado are most worried about things like the cost of housing, groceries, and of course the cost of health care.
Yeah.
We got to get the government open to start tackling those problems. And you know, my view is, of course, we did that in the House. We passed a clean bipartisan bill to keep the government open. The Senate needs to do its job, pass that bill as well. But I'm hopeful that we can get that done soon. I think now that we passed the election, there's a real opportunity to get some work done. And we need to be ready to hit the ground running. And that's what I'm doing with my colleagues on the Republican side and on the Democratic side.
And is that what got you to sign on to this statement? I mean, customers on Colorado's health insurance marketplace will see their premiums double on average, and tens of thousands will lose access to health care, according to an analysis by your state. I mean, is that what brought you to this place to sign on with Democrats and Republicans here?
Well, sure. I've also been on legislation previously that's been introduced a couple months ago that would just do a straight extension of the enhanced premium tax credits for a year. There was bipartisan support for that as well. I think this is something that addresses some of the concerns that we've heard on the Republican side and on the Democratic side about some of the imperfections and ways that we can improve the enhanced premium tax credits and phasing out income levels. You don't want a family that's earning $800,000 necessarily getting these tax credits. We want to make sure that we have reforms verifying eligibility. We want to check death records. We want to prevent things called ghost beneficiaries, where these tax credits are going to the people that are no longer existing or alive. And we want to, you know, require better notice so that people know the value of the subsidy. So there's a start of it that was a couple months ago, but this is kind of an advancement of that issue that I think is more serious, more substantive, and has a better chance of getting legislative momentum.
What makes you more optimistic in this moment? I mean, what we've been hearing from Democrats is that they don't really trust Republicans to play ball and follow through. They don't trust that if they do negotiate, that it will be honored if it passes the Senate in the House with the president. That's something we heard from Senator Sanders. They want guarantees that whatever agreement happens is guaranteed across the board. What do you say to that?
Well, it's tough to guarantee the outcome of any vote. That's something that I haven't seen at all happen here in Congress. What I can tell you is that there's a seriousness and a willingness to commit by Republicans like myself and Don Bacon and others as well. On addressing these issues. Like I said, this is not a red state or a blue state issue, the cost of health insurance premiums. It is something serious. If we want to really serve our constituents, we really need to tackle this problem. And this is an important start to that.
Have there been any conversations with the president? And also, why did the Republican co-chair of the caucus not sign on to this?
You'll have to ask Congressman Fitzpatrick about that specifically. I'll tell you that the response that we've gotten from the White House and from leadership is, you know, there's not necessarily the criticism that you'd expect if they were completely opposing this idea. So I'm encouraged by the response that we've gotten, which is more pragmatic and, hey, let's get the government back open and then we can start talking about this.
Congressman Jeff Hurd, Republican of Colorado, thank you so much for your time.
Happy to join you, Leila.
The government shutdown has also seen too few air traffic controllers showing up for work. NPR's Joel Rose reports that the Federal Aviation Administration is responding by reducing air traffic by 10% across some of the nation's busiest airports starting tomorrow.
The FAA is planning to reduce air traffic in 40 high-volume markets. FAA Administrator Brian Bedford says the agency wants to relieve the pressure at those airports before safety is compromised.
We're not going to wait until we see something flashing red to say, oh, we should take action now.
The FAA has been delaying flights at some airports because of staffing shortages among air traffic controllers. Those controllers are required to work without pay during the shutdown. Some have taken second jobs and many are calling out sick. Bedford says those who are working are starting to show signs of stress and fatigue.
We just can't ignore it, you know, and we're not going to wait for a safety problem to truly manifest itself when the early indicators are telling us we can take action today to prevent things from deteriorating.
The FAA did not announce which airports would be affected by the reductions, but the agency has noted persistent staffing shortages at air traffic control facilities around some of the nation's busiest airports, including major airline hubs in Dallas, Houston, Newark, New Jersey, and Phoenix. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy acknowledged these reductions will likely cause widespread frustration, but he said the decision was not taken lightly.
Our heart, you know, goes out to those who will have flights disrupted. We are doing our work, and this is what we feel like we have to do to make sure we maintain that safety profile.
Duffy said he and Bedford would meet with airline leaders to figure out how to implement the reductions fairly. The airlines are now scrambling to sort out what this means and explain it to their customers. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Good morning. It's 6:19. You're tuned in to National Public Radio's Morning Edition on the KAXE Morning Show. It's people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up, we talk with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin, talk about his 40th season of fishing. He just ended his fishing season, and we'll take a look back with him. Stay tuned for that. Here's what the weather is looking like. Cloudy skies with highs in the mid to upper 40s. Chance of sprinkles this afternoon and breezy southeast winds 5 to 15. Cloudy overnight with a slight chance of rain, lows 29 to 35. And southeast winds 5 to 15 tonight. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs 35 to 38. Temperatures falling in the evening to 16 degrees to 23. And Saturday, partly sunny with highs 30 to 33 degrees. Coming up later this morning, we welcome Megan Buffington from our newsroom. We'll talk about some of the news coming this week in northern Minnesota. And then we'll be hearing a new segment from the newsroom from Megan. It's North Star Student. We'll be meeting a student from our region and learn more about them. Stay tuned for that conversation, the North Star student coming up before 9 o'clock. And don't forget, it is hunting season, begins Saturday. The firearm deer season opens up, and we are looking to share some stories. We want to hear from you. Do you have a family hunting shack? Do you have all the roles? Are you the cook? Who are you in the hunting shack? Or maybe you spend this weekend hanging out with friends. We'd love to hear from you. You can text us 218-326-1234. We'd like to thank Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty for their support. They help guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, more at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com.
Gone fishing. There's a sign up on your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You bother me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing.
Bapa, baby, bapa, bapa, bapa.
Oh, yeah.
Thursday mornings at this time, we get a chance to check in with Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. You're welcome.
All right, so congratulations. You just finished up your 40th fishing season.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing about that is that I still feel like the new guy. And so, like, maybe a couple days ago in the morning, early, I didn't have as much to do as usual, so I was thinking about that, and I couldn't really almost believe it. So I actually had to take an Excel spreadsheet and list out the dates and count them up just to make sure that that was really true. And I added it all up, and the arithmetic doesn't really lie. In fact, if you wanted to, you could count before we moved to Deer River in 85 and got started doing this. I spent a few years down in the Twin Cities kind of getting my feet wet, so to speak, and did some part-time guiding on there. So you could add a few years if you want to count the part-time stuff before that. But I decided I think I'm going to stick with whenever it became kind of the main source of this is going to be your job and there's no safety net. You're either going to make it or not. And so 40 years, no, I just have to figure out what I'm going to do for the next 40 years.
Well, I'm sure that you thought fishing over the years would change when you started out 40 years ago, but who would have predicted the world we live in now with technology and everything that has changed? Or has it? Maybe it hasn't for you. I don't know.
Things have changed quite a bit. The here's the one thing that's the crazy thing that seems to stay constant, despite all of the things that have changed along the way. The fish still somehow or another figure out a way to avoid enough of us so that they can continue to produce a new year class. This, I was having a discussion with somebody from the technical work group meeting that was about a week ago or a little over a week ago in Brainerd. And a friend of mine, we were talking about this and, you know, wringing of hands and trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to be protective of the fish and so on and so forth. And I reminded him that the first time we ever got really serious about, you know, there was a little bit of grumbling going on back in my formative years. We just had a little flasher on the back of the boat. You knew how deep it was, and you could see if there was fish below you at the moment, you could see that. You had no idea what kind of fish they were or how they related to a structure. You just had to figure that stuff out on your own. But then came along the paper graph. And I had one of the earliest versions of the paper graph, and now this could kind of print out. You could see sizes of fish relative to another size. And I remember some grumbling going on about how that was going to be the thing that would wreck fishing. And then down the line a little bit more, it was the underwater camera was the thing that was going to wreck fishing. And there have been a number of renditions of different technologies that have come along that have been the thing that was going to wreck fishing. But out of all those changes, the one thing that really, and now I don't mean this in a negative way whatsoever, but the one thing that really did change fishing for everybody across the country was when the paper map that you had to kind of fold out and look at a map of the lake and sort of try to figure out where you were, when the charts became available so that they could be installed right on your GPS unit, and now you have an accurate map of the lake in real time along with where your position is on the lake, and you can track the drop off and see where the points are and the holes and so on and so forth. That's the one thing that was the great equalizer for everybody in fishing. Whenever I was starting off, there would be times that you'd be fishing on a bigger lake or someplace that, you know, needed to, you really couldn't just figure it out and, you know, go out in a day or two and learn what was going on that lake. People staying at resorts or locals that would be out fishing for the day would come up alongside of you. If they saw that you had a depth finder or a graph on your boat, they may ask you how deep it was out there or what you were fishing for or so on and so forth. Is it a hump or point or whatever? Once everybody, the spread of the paper or the integrated chart onto your GPS machine, all of a sudden everybody had that information already, and there was no more people asking questions about the water depth or where they were on the lake or anything like that. Now everybody knows everything about everything. If you want to find your way around on the lake, you just turn your GPS on, call up the map, and you can go and fish a brand new body of water just like you've been fishing it for 20 years. So I think that's the one main thing that's really been a glaring change over the time that I've been in. And then, of course, now we're talking about some newer, you know, more modern technology, things that potentially could pose some threats to certain fish species under some circumstances. And I think that, you know, we'll have to pay attention to that. But like I said, somehow or another, up to this point, the fish continually figure out a way to keep producing new year classes. Most of the fish, or let's just say all of the fish, when that big the big scare came out about 1999, and everybody was convinced that the underwater camera was going to be the end of fishing as we know it. The fish that we were trying to protect, there was actually legislation to try and ban that underwater camera. Every single one of the fish that we were trying to protect at that time are all dead and gone. So somehow, whatever we're fishing for has occurred since then. New year classes have come along, and the population has been, you know, they have their ups and downs, but they come and go, and seem to be able to keep figuring out a way to find and catch new populations of fish. So I think you should be optimistic from that point of view, that no matter what does come along, there's always a way to figure out how to deal with it.
So, Jeff, looking at your 40 years, has business always been strong? Did you have lean years where you didn't have as busy of a summer?
The first couple of years, I spent a lot of time writing letters to different companies trying to get somebody to support me, you know, to sponsor this or, you know, kind of back that. After about 1987 or 88, maybe the first 3 years, let's say, were a little bit lean and I had some free time. Once I got established, though, it's pretty much been busy straight on through the whole time. I've told people this before in the boat, you know, there's 350 million people roughly in the country, and I only need to know like 150 of them. So it's not really a big job to get busy, and I see a lot of the newer guides that start up, is provided that they, you know, if they offer good customer service to people and they treat their customers well and they get repeat business, it doesn't take real long to get established and get to be kind of busy. Now, if you just like to run out and show people how good you are at catching a fish and let them sit in the boat and watch you, you're not going to be very busy. That, you know, people kind of mistake sometimes. I love fishing, and so I want to be a fishing guide. Well, if that's how you want to approach it, you probably would be better off to be a tournament fisherman or something along those lines, where you get to do what's all about you, because the fishing guide business is really a customer service operation, and so your focus has to be on how happy your customers are. Even if it's not, you know, there's been a lot of days where I would have preferred to do something different than what I'm doing at the time, but I'm trying to make it the best experience for the customer. So you have to make some compromises and be willing to bend in that way. So once you do that, then yeah, you tend to be busy and it tends to be pretty steady. So I've been blessed. When it comes to that, I've been very, very lucky. I had no idea when we moved up. If there was, you know, I thought maybe I'd make it 1 or 2 years and I could wind up, you know, getting a job doing something. You know, I figured I could do something one way or the other. I didn't never realize for a second that I would never have to fall back on anything. So here we are.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the stuff you do currently, and that includes being involved in work groups. Tell us about some of the topics at the recent DNR Panfish work group and the technology.
Yeah. Yeah, the big interrelated thing. I think we touched last week on the technology work group. And since then, now, there's been another meeting. We've had the two of them, I guess, actually, the Winnie meeting, Lake Winnebagoche work group has had a meeting. And then the most recent one, the Panfish work group. Now, we've done on that Panfish group, I didn't realize how long I've been on that. It's been about 10 years now or a little over. And primarily that Quality Sunfish Initiative was the big thing going through the state, trying to identify and single out lakes that are capable of producing large sunfish. And in some cases, you know, the Quality Sunfish Initiative was aimed at either preserving the known places where big sunfish existed, or figuring out how to fix places where they used to have them and then, for whatever reason, the populations of big fish had declined. So that's kind of in its midway since that big push to get those lakes into that system. We're about midway now. And so they're just beginning to evaluate the success of that. And so the current things, there's some crappie population dynamic studies that are starting up now. And the tie-in between the panfish group and the technology group is with these population studies and so on going on. The tie-in with the forward-facing sonar is a thing, the big mystery that everybody is trying to figure out, you know, is there something that needs to be done about it? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? The only area of concern for me right now, we had a couple years ago, Angling Buzz and the DNR kind of teamed up. In my own way, I feel like I sort of got the ball rolling on the whole Barotrava thing early on, but at some point, you know, somebody that had more clout than me had to kind of take that ball and run with it. So I'm glad they did. But Angling Buzz and the DNR did a barotrauma study on crappies. And that video was published in November of 23, towards the end of the month in 2023. Since that time, barotrauma, I think they kind of almost looked at that once that video was out, that was sort of like the end of that project and nothing really new on the horizon. Well, now with the forward sonar, we're starting to see the concerns about what about targeting, singling out muskies in deep water or singling out big, you know, like 8, 9, 10 pound walleyes in deep water. And so that's something that's going to have to be addressed because we have no real information. I can't tell you how many of those fish survive and how many don't. And I've been asking questions around the DNR. Nobody seems to really have a 100% handle on what that number is. So now you have to ask the question, if you take any lake in our region, they've almost all got some sort of a protected slot. And if there isn't a protected slot, then you have a statewide one fish over 20 inches in possession. Well, if that fish is protected by law, but I purposely go out knowing, let's just say that I'm making up numbers now, so don't quote me on any of this, but let's say I catch 10 30-inch walleyes in a day, and I catch all 10 of those fish in 30 feet of water plus. Some percentage, I don't know if it'll be one fish or three fish or five fish or even more, some number of those fish is going to die in that day. But I'm only allowed I could legally kill and possess one fish over 20 inches in the state of Minnesota. So as soon as I catch those 10, knowing that some portion of them are die, I have kind of violated that law. Even though I'm justifying that violation by saying, well, no, I released them and they all swam away, so therefore they're going to be good. So I think that's the one thing that I see now that's going to have to get addressed is what do we do about this? And you know where we're going to wind up. It's going to be, there is not going to be a way to regulate this. The cat is out of the bag. The technology is out there. We're going to have to figure out a way to just teach each other to be decent about how we use things. And so that seems like it these days. It seems like I'm always winding up preaching to people the best thing to do is to just keep educating. And you know, peer pressure has got to work better than telling a guy what to do and what not to do, especially when you don't even know yourself, you know, what the actual outcome is going to be. So I guess that's where we're at right now, and that's the meeting process. Now we've got the next thing coming up will be the DNR roundtable on January 9th. So that has become sort of a prepackaged, lots of presentations. Folks are showing you not just fishing, but hunting and the ecosystems and parks and trails, and everybody is down there kind of showing off what they've been doing for the last week. So whatever new news we get from the work groups, that will come out in about 2 months, give or take, and along the way we'll be scheduling some more meetings. So we should have quite a bit to talk about along those lines throughout the rest of the winter.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time, but I bet you're already starting to think about ice fishing.
I've been thinking about ice fishing for a little while. In fact, Susan just asked me the difference between the wrap season ending last year and this year, and I think I feel a little bit better about it now. We got out a couple times, and we were able to check out a couple of lakes and see some territory, get some ideas for the ice fishing season coming up. I don't know what's going to happen after this coming next few days, but it looks like the weather is going to be cold enough now, so we just decided to go ahead, and it takes a little bit to drain all the water, get the motor dried out, make sure that all the minnow tanks are empty, and so on and so forth. So for me, my boat is put away, and I'm done for the season. But if you've got, you know, something that doesn't take a lot of effort, you know, just a simple fishing boat without live wells and water systems and all that kind of stuff, there might still be some opportunity to get out. And we've talked before, it's a good time to just, if nothing else, just run around the lake, look for where the structures are that might be kind of interesting when the ice does form, look for schools of fish, mark them. You don't even have to fish for them, you just have to know where they are now. Because once the ice forms, they'll be in those same locations for probably 3 to 4 weeks or so, something like that. First ice until maybe, let's say, the early part of January. So that'd be something that I'd look forward to now. And if you didn't get your boat put away yet, I would suggest looking at the weather forecast for this weekend and maybe getting that done today while we still got a chance of some above freezing temperatures, because it doesn't look like we're going to escape freeze up here, at least, you know, shallow shoreline water and stuff like that. It's going to probably start to show some ice here in the next few days.
Yeah, I was seeing the forecast for tomorrow and during the day, temperatures falling. That's new language for the season. So it's going to be like 16 to 23 tomorrow night around the region. So there we go. We're getting, seasons are changing. Thanks for your time as always, Jeff.
You bet. Thank you. See ya.
See ya. You can find more information at jeffsundin.com. Coming up, we've got national native news. President Donald Trump wants the Department of Defense to resume nuclear weapons testing immediately. He has instructed the DOD to immediately begin the testing, and the directive has been sending shockwaves around the West. National Native News has the story.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump wants the Defense Department to resume nuclear weapons testing immediately. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, that's sending shockwaves around the West.
Prior to a moratorium imposed by Congress in 1992, the U.S. conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests, mostly done at the Nevada test site, even hundreds of above-ground detonations.
We can't fully rule it out. That would be extremely provocative.
Daryl Kimball is executive director of the Nonpartisan Arms Control Association.
I don't think people need to fear mushroom clouds on the desert floor outside of Las Vegas, but the very notion of resuming nuclear testing, in my view, is a disrespectful slap in the face to those who in the past have suffered from radiation poisoning from nuclear testing fallouts in the Mountain West.
Like Leslie Begay, a former Navajo uranium miner. He's also a Vietnam vet and cancer survivor, having a double lung transplant with 123 stitches in all.
That was the hardest thing I ever encountered. These are some of the things that people are going to go through.
Compensation for radiation exposure victims was revived this summer. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
Residents of St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea have traditionally subsisted on walrus, whales, and fish. But availability of marine resources has been changing, and reindeer have become a staple. Now, Savunga is almost done building a meat processing facility that can turn it into a business. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Richmond Tooley rides his four-wheeler across the wet tundra outside of Savunga. The mountains of black volcanic rock glisten behind him in the September sun, and the Bering Sea in front. Tooley is a third-generation chief reindeer herder. He pauses to spot the animals through his binoculars.
All summer, there are reindeer out here.
St. Lawrence Island sits 100 miles west from mainland Alaska, with two villages on it, Savunga and Gamble. It's also home to several thousand free-range reindeer. In the late 1800s, famine struck the island, and the animals were introduced here as a food source. Today, the herd continues to support the island as warming conditions disrupt subsistence and storms can hold up food deliveries for weeks. Now, Savunga is building a reindeer meat processing facility. Freeman Kinnicook is the business director of the Savunga Reindeer Commercial Company, a subsidiary of the village that will manage the facility. He says the plan is to slaughter reindeer about four times a year and sell it locally. In the future, there might be a chance to distribute it to other Alaska villages as well.
When we did those trial runs, we would sell on Facebook, and we couldn't keep up with the demand. It's undecided who the market is, but I know there's a market for it.
Perry Idiganak Pangowi is a subsistence hunter and one of the locals working on a project. Pangowi says the new facility already brought a much-needed influx of jobs to the village and might open new economic opportunities.
It would be nice to have our stores selling our local reindeer because it's hard to afford that steak. It's like $50, $60 for a piece of steak. And to me, reindeer tastes a lot better than steak.
Construction is scheduled to be completed in the coming weeks. With reporting from Savunga, I am Alena Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the, no, not the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, no longer.
No longer. But we receive support from you, our listeners. Thank you so much for showing up for us time and time again. We're turning 50 in 2026.
So we can kick.
We can kick. You know, 50.
Yeah, we got to do a lot of that next year.
I sense some merch coming on, but then we probably need to copyright that.
Yeah, I suppose.
I feel like we could get a good image of Heather doing a good kick. Kick.
Not so much me. That's not my forte, just lengthwise and all. I mean, I can do it because I'm over 50, and so I can still kick, but there you go. Yeah, we're excited. It's going to be a great new year. It's great right now because you've been there to support us. We are just putting our heads down and doing the work that local media needs to do to connect you, to lift you up, to let you know what's going on. We are going to be talking about today. We've got the bright spot. So we love to bring you a little bit of joy from our region. And we've all been hearing about how, you know, last Saturday, November 1st, was the beginning, because of the federal shutdown, of the loss of SNAP benefits. And lots of organizations we've been connecting with. We have an amazing resource on our website, our news team put together. But people, individuals, are also saying, hey, I really want to do something. So we're going to bring you a conversation. We'll be talking with one of our volunteers, Gina the Knife.
I love this.
She and a friend have set up a way to help folks out during this time. So we'll learn about that coming up at 8:10. It's a Bemidji tailgate pantry.
And to that point, Heidi, about that we're putting our heads down and just doing the work, if anything, this whole experience in the last summer, I think, has made us understand just how important our work is for the local communities. So, you know, I think that our listeners have felt that too. So just a big thank you. We had a great week last week, just sending out gratitude to everyone who's helped us out, especially in this last 6 months.
Yeah, we love hearing from you. We need you not only as support, but to tell other people about us and to let us know about the stories in your community. Let us know what's going on. You can email news@kaxc.org or text us anytime. Keep us company during the morning show. Give us a text. What are you up to? 218-326-1234. Were you like Kari? Did you get to see the northern lights last night and the most amazing sunrise?
I mean,
I'm a little bit jealous.
The sky is giving some real gifts right now. Last night, I live in town. I'm right in town in Grand Rapids. And we got a text from a friend who also lives in town.
Mm-hmm.
Told us that the yes, exactly. So we went out. Ended up bringing both of our kids. We woke our daughter up, which she missed it. We saw the dancing. I mean, they were dancing. They were so brilliantly bright. And then, of course, as soon as we got our 8-year-old up, they stopped. and then this morning, as I was coming down the hill into work, the most unbelievable sunrise.
Mm.
It was so beautiful.
Yeah, I've been loving the moon. I was out a little... out early yesterday driving to Bemidji, and that was just like a spotlight on Highway 2 the whole way. And last night was out and came home and just the moon, I'm telling you.
I know.
All the things right now, I think it keeps us going as the seasons change. It's sort of the lull before we get the cold and the snow and start reacquainting ourselves with what to do in the wintertime and get outside and all of that.
That has been a bit of a transition for me this year, more so than I feel like in years past. But I would even say before the time change, I've just been so sleepy at night.
Oh,
and yeah. That's not a normal, I guess that doesn't normally happen to me.
Do you feel like, do you think you're getting enough sleep per night? What
probably
would be your
not.
Average? Okay.
About 6 hours.
Okay.
So not terrible.
Yeah.
But not the recommended.
But I think, I mean, this is what they say, and I don't know who they are, but like one of the most healthy things and good things you can do for yourself is to get sleep for your body, to get rest.
It's like so important on so many levels. I mean, like it helps prevent dementia. Like there's so many long-term things with it.
So I think when you're sleepy, I think go with it. Don't feel like you got to keep yourself awake.
I know.
But I know. It's also the thing of like, I one time asked Andrew Dezingle, like I just was like, do you go to bed early on Tuesday nights before the Wednesday morning show? And he's like, no, I can't. It's like midnight or something. And I was like, yeah, I end up staying up late. And I'm like, why do we do this? And
I know.
And he goes, because you can't let the man win. And I was like, whoa, that makes some sense to me, because it's sort of like,
you're not in charge of me. I'm in charge of me.
Well, yeah. Or it's like once you went away to college or hit 18 and left your family's home or whatever, you realize, like, what? I get to choose this? Even though I didn't have necessarily strict bedtimes.
Right.
But no one's telling you what to do. And I think sometimes you just don't lose that because you're like, oh, I want to watch this or I want to do this thing. I don't care if it's 11:30 at night.
Right. I end up going to bed earlier on Thursday nights.
Mm. Oh, because of this morning?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that ends up usually being, I always have grand ideas of going to bed early on a Wednesday night. It just usually doesn't happen.
And before, coming up, we'll have the set list. But before we get to that, yesterday when I was on with Andrew, too, he was just cracking me up because he was talking about his nightmares. Did you hear us talking?
No, I missed this part.
Okay, so he just said that it's kind of disappointing because as an adult, nightmares are about, like, he had a nightmare that he missed the morning show.
Oh,
he woke
work.
Up late, right? And he goes, when I was a kid, it was about monsters. Like, this is just ridiculous. Where are the monsters nowadays? Which I just think is fascinating, like how they change.
I have never had a work stress dream.
Oh, but school.
Yep, I still have like college stress dreams. And it's not like high school or it's college. I'm enrolled in a class and it's the end of the semester and I don't know where the class is and I don't know where my books are and I've never attended the class and I got to show up for the final. It's usually what that happens. Do you have work stress dreams?
Yeah. Oh yeah. All the time. And I was telling him that I did earlier this week because it's been a busy week, lots of meetings and, you know, we've got this new podcast to do. And I was just like, normally we've only been doing it 4 weeks. So normal maybe isn't the right word, but the timing is a little different this week. That's all I'm going to say. Not much.
Okay.
And I like kept waking up worried about it. Like, oh, I can't get it
done.
Oh, I can't get it done.
I stress about work.
Okay.
That's not what I'm saying but what I'm saying is I've never had a dream about like being on air.
Oh,
like,
I have.
Like work doesn't live in my dreams. But so when I'm stressed, it comes out as a school. Mm. Like that's my stress dream.
No, I've had the kind of everything went wrong on the air.
Yeah.
You know, similar to your school thing.
Right. Like, yep.
Nothing is working. Nobody's here. You know,
it's just weird to me that my brain still goes back to college because I never had that kind of a stress experience in college. Mm. So why wouldn't it be what maybe I deal with on the daily?
Maybe it's a gift to yourself because you wake up and you're like, I'm not in school anymore. You know?
Well, yeah. It's a Thursday morning show. We've got a great show ahead for you. If you've got any pictures of the sky this morning or of the Northern Lights last night, did you see them? Text us 218-326-1234. Support on KAXE comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, operating fiber optic, fast internet speeds up to 10 gig, and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at five shows this week, November 6th through the 8th, in Gilbert, Grand Rapids, Nisswa, and Bemidji. First up, Rich Mattson is performing solo at the Ore House in Gilbert Thursday at 6 p.m. The Minnesota music scene veteran of bands like The Bitter Spills, Glenn Russell's, Ole Yeller, Tired Eyes, and many more is still going strong with his current band, the North Stars. He plays solo sets every first Thursday at the Ore House in Gilbert. On Friday, Michaela James is playing at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 6 o'clock. She is a singer-songwriter from Rapids who is currently based in the Twin Cities. She specializes in acoustic sets with guitar and ukulele. Michaela James at Rapids Brewing this Friday. Annie Humphrey and the Fire in the Village Collective have two stops on their fall music and arts tour this weekend. On Friday, they will be at their Room 203 space at the Old Central School in Grand Rapids, part of the First Friday Art Walk. Then on Saturday, they will be at Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji. Concerts with Humphrey are both days at 7 p.m., with additional arts events and gathering time during the day. The theme for the fall tour is the Warriors and the Powerless. One more show is the latest in the Grassroots Concert Series in Nisswa. Folk singer Kelly Hunt is playing at 7 p.m. Friday night. Based in New Orleans, Hunt's music draws from a wide range of influences, like the classic folk of Joni Mitchell, blues of Mississippi John Hurt, and even classical composers. It's Kelly Hunt this Friday at the Journey Church in Nisswa. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
.657 coming up. We'll have local news with the Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton with Kari Headland. Hope you're having a good Thursday. It is Thursday, November 6th. We've got a lot of wrap-up. You know, this was election week and kind of a off year with the presidential election last year, but that didn't mean northern Minnesotans weren't going to the polls.
We've got lots of school
referendums and school board elections, and you can get the latest at kexe.org, and we'll talk with Megan Buffington a little bit about this as well.
Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji. Since 2009, Boreal Brushworks has provided full-service interior and exterior painting services throughout northern Minnesota. More information about estimates and services available at borealbrushworkspainting.com.
And thanks goes out to Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids with the Scratch Bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special orders available and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
Curl, there are a couple curling club open houses this week. Curl Masabi and Eveleth has open houses through tonight from 6 to 8. Curling instruction and equipment are provided. Bring clean athletic shoes and wear comfortable clothing and a light jacket. Then the Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids is offering nightly learn to curl sessions through tomorrow night. Drop in also from 6 to 7:30 any evening to learn the sport of curling. Again, bring clean sneakers and wear comfortable clothes.
I think every event should have a tell you what to wear. I think that's a really good idea.
I think so too. I also love the opening up to, I think it's a really smart thing to just open it up to for people to just try.
Mm-hmm.
It like removes that barrier of, I've never done it before. I feel weird about going in there. I'm not welcome. I think all places should do that.
Yeah. Well, we're doing it next week.
Yeah, that's true. You can learn more about being a DJ. You're not committing to anything, just like with this curling club stuff. You can wear whatever you want.
Oh, I think you should give a little dress code. Wear a band shirt? No, I don't know.
Sure. Yeah, sure. We can say that. Wear a band shirt, but you won't be removed if you're not.
Right.
So we have classes. We're always looking for new volunteers, people who love music, love sharing music. So on Wednesday, November 12th, we have a class at KAXE. And on Thursday, November 13th, we have a class at KBXE in Bemidji. Both of them run from 5:30 to 7. You just need to attend one. It's a great way to just find out more about the station, about the format. How does this work? Do we mandate what you play? We don't. I'm just going to give you a hint. We don't. Mm-hmm. We do have a format, but we do not mandate what you play. Mm-hmm. And you also just...